You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
The Major Spoilers Podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
Welcome to issue 746 of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Thank you for downloading. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing this episode with a friend. Oh, I know what you're thinking, Stephen. What is going on? Typically, there's a bunch of other people around chitty-chatting and doing their own thing. And that's right. Generally and normally, there are some other people around. But this week is a little bit different, especially if you listened to last week's show where I kind of hinted that I was going to try to get an interview together. And I do enjoy talking with creators. I enjoy talking with writers and artists. And when there's a connection that I have with someone, I like to bring them on the show and talk to them. Now, a lot of people here at Major Spoilers have written things. Of course, Rodrigo has The Tale of Tallest Rabbit, which you can get over at Amazon.com. And of course, use that link at MajorSpoilers.com to kick a little back our way. I have been a contributor to eight different volumes of the Adobe After Effects Classroom in a Book series over the last 10, 12 years, something like that. Or maybe it's 8 years. I think it's 12 years. Ashley and Jason, of course, have some comic book work that's coming up, including Jupiter Jet, which should arrive, I'm thinking, in around December. So you'll want to grab that as well. And so, you know, people here at Major Spoilers are writers and creators. And in fact, there's a lot of people who follow us who are creators and writers. And if you're a follower or a listener of our Finally Friday show, you know, Bill Swigert calls in occasionally, and he's got about 3 books, 4 books under his belt right now that you can also pick up on Amazon.com. He's a super nice guy. And I found out this week that our guest this week is also a listener of the Major Spoilers Podcast and Critical Hit and everything that we do. And he has also written a book, this one about comic shops. So please take a listen to my interview with Dan Guarino as he talks about comic shops and a little bit of the history and what's coming up in his new book that arrives in October. Comic book shops. There's about 3,000 of them in the United States. And if you've listened to me talk on the Finally Friday podcast or any of the other shows, you know that I kind of have a love-hate relationship with comic shops, especially when I don't have any in my immediate area. Fortunately, I have someone who is an expert on everything comic shops. In fact, he's got a brand new book out, or coming out very soon. It's called Comic Shop, The Retail Mavericks Who Gave Us a New Geek Culture. It's Dan Guarino. Dan, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Stephen.
So, for some reason, when I'm reading your book, I was really surprised that it was not until 1968 that we get a first, quote-unquote, real comic book shop. For some reason, I always thought that they were around in, like, 1961, but I'm off by many years.
Well, it's funny when you start to talk about what the first comic shop was, because it all depends on how you define comic shop.
Right.
And comic fans, being the way that we are, will kind of have these micro definitions. So the shops that opened in 1968, one of those was called Seven Sons. It was opened in San Jose, California, by a bunch of teenagers. That was, you were starting to see shops around that time that would be recognizable to us as comic shops.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, you would have seen these great old used bookstores, or maybe even small used bookstores that had comic sections,
right,
and things like that. But yeah, it's interesting that it wasn't until the late '60s, and really more like the early to mid 70s that you started to see a comic specialty store that would be recognizable to you and me.
Yeah, I just find it fascinating. I mean, when you think about it, it makes sense that it was probably by the late 60s that a comic shop would open in the way that we know it today, because we could go to a newsstand if those were still around. We could have gone to a grocery store, and I still remember a grocery store near me that had a comic book section in the magazine aisle. And then, of course, comics are still around in the Archie Digest are still around in the checkout. And then you had drugstores, and there was at least one drugstore in a town just not too far away from me, the next town over, that had a comic book section in its drug magazine area of the drugstore. And I found that really fascinating at the time. But of course, by the time I was getting into comic books and reading comic books on a regular basis, I had discovered the true comic shops, and that was in the 1980s. But I still remember going to like places like Our Town and Country, which is kind of like a farm and, just a general store kind of place. And they would have, bagged comics that you could buy 3 for $1. And I was reading all that stuff in the 70s. So, yeah, I guess it kind of makes sense that in the early days of comics, it took a while for people to say, there's a market in just specializing in this. But that had to do with a lot of the change in how comics were distributed, though.
Yeah, what was happening was the audience was becoming more sophisticated. So if you go back to, say, the 1940s or 1950s, comics were, and they still were into the 60s and 70s, but comics were viewed as a disposable medium. And, this was kid stuff. Older people did read some comics. Some comics were written for older audiences. But it was just kind of this, not a medium not taken very seriously. Then in the 60s, you start to see this flowering of fan culture. You see this growth of fanzines. You see this, some of the first great conventions. And one of the things that went along with that was you want to read all the issues. So you read this issue of Black Hawk and you missed an issue because you couldn't find it on your newsstand. So you have a friend through mail order through pen pals or through these kind of fan networks. And the fact that there was this demand for back issues and this demand for complete sets of things, it helped to create the need for comic shops. And that just didn't exist in, decades earlier in any sort of substantial form. If it's 1942 and you missed an issue of Action Comics, it's no big deal. I mean, the idea of serialized storytelling from issue to issue, and also just the sophistication of the audience was such that you could just kind of pick up any comic, and it didn't make much difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So as I think about the processes, how we go, stories that I've always heard is that, especially in the distribution method, it was you had the publishers that would send to a distributor who would then send out to the grocery stores or to the newsstands or to the drugstores. At that time, if you wanted to get credit for a comic that wasn't sold, you simply had to rip the cover off and send the cover back. And basically you would toss out, supposedly destroy, the rest of the comic. But that was not the thing that was going on. And so, if I'm not mistaken, there were, some drugstores and some other dealers that were selling these torn comics for, like pennies on the nickel or whatever it was. And they were making a little side business in the trade of these destroyed or supposedly destroyed comics. And then as people started to, again, see this need for collectability, especially as, dealers like Mile High Comics started coming about and dealing with back issues to collectors, that it makes sense that a comic book shop would finally emerge.
And it was this thing you're talking about is what was this kind of retailer and distributor fraud, essentially, mm-hmm. in getting returns and getting credits for things that they were still selling. And the founder of Mile High Comics, Chuck Rosansky, was one of the people who had the most colorful tales about distributor fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And a good friend of his, Jim Shooter, the former Marvel editor-in-chief also, talked about how they knew that this was going on and they would see evidence of it. But the news distributors who distributed magazines and newspapers and comics, a lot of times they were so powerful and had such, were so entrenched in their local territories, you just couldn't do anything about it.
And in some cases,
I should also note,
I was going to say, some of these cases, there's a little bit of mob activity maybe in some of these distributors, right?
There was talk of mob activity. So, for instance, one of the things Jim Shooter told me was that there was a distributor who was asking for credit that was greater than 100% of their orders.
Oh, man.
So they were somehow saying that they – I don't even know how you explain that. But he was saying that they shouldn't allow this. And he was told by one of his supervisors – just don't bother that particular distributor. Don't mess with that guy. And there were rumors of mob ties at several of these regional distributors. I should say though that this idea of there being mob ties with the old news distributors, and also this affidavit fraud, it's one of those things where the evidence that I found was all secondhand evidence. One thing that I would love to get my hands on is just, you know, the documents showing that it happened.
Right.
It was one of those things that there are some things for which there's a clear trail of evidence, and there are some things that all I have to rely on are just the kind of the statements of people who were there and who saw it happen. And I wish that some of that. Some of that stuff was more solid because it's just fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. So who can we pin the first real comic book shop on? Is there one person or one location?
Well, that realizing that to put anyone forward is hazardous because I'll get hit by mortar fire from 20 different sides. One of the things that I say in the book is I feel like a key early store, like if I was forced at gunpoint to say, at what point was there a store that felt like a comic shop? What I would say is that a likely candidate. So can you see all the different ways in which I'm kind of covering my rear end and throwing in caveats here?
Yeah.
But a likely candidate is a store called Victory Thrift that was in Queens.
Mm-hmm.
And it was owned by a very young man named Robert Bell. Now, you and I know from reading comics in the 80s that Robert Bell had ads in almost all the comics.
Yep.
Where you could send off for a list. And he was in Florida at that time. He was in Long Island before that. But before he was exclusively a mail order dealer, he had a little shop in Queens. And he opened his shop, and I believe it was 1961, and he found that comics were this growing source of interest for his consumers. So comics were a small share when he opened the business, but they grew and grew and grew. He also found that comics in good condition, especially key issues, would sell for much more than cover price. And he was one of these people who would put out this organized selection of back issues. He also made his own comic bags. He later commissioned a contract manufacturer to make mass-produced comic bags, which may be the first comic bags, the first mass-produced comic bags. I have yet to see an example of anyone else doing this.
Yeah.
So the story that I hear is it was from Jim Hanley, the great New York retailer, and he talks about arriving at Robert Bell's store in 1968, just, you know, this kid who's really into comics and getting to that front display window and just being his mind blown, you know, that the place where you could see Action Comics number one, where all of the key issues were, you know, where, and it was there. It was almost as if this was created for fans in a way that other shops were just these kind of poorly run junk stores.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. That's one that should definitely be part of the conversation, and that was one that definitely predates some of the San Jose stores. And the problem with all of this, though, is to name a first store, you have to come up with an agreed upon definition of comic shop.
Right.
And also, part of the fun is that everyone just disagrees, and you can always find some guy somewhere that'll say, "Oh yeah, you know, there was a comic book store in Bristol in 1846. And,
right.
I got the, you know, so yeah, you just, but Robert Bell's store would be one that, I would nominate that one.
It also seems, and this is from your book too, it seems like the rise of the comic book shop also kind of coincides with like true indie and underground comics.
It's so they are separate but frequently related developments. So the first issue of Zap Comics comes out in 68.
Mm-hmm.
And Zap Comics had a national method of distributing itself that was outside of the regular news distributors. Underground Comics is this fascinating story. I kept looking for clear connections between the kind of the business of Underground Comics and the business of Marvel and DC and Archie and Warren.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the early retailers sold both. They would sell Underground Comics and they would sell the, they called them the code comics because those were all the comics code comics, like
yeah.
From the major publishers.
Yeah.
But as far as the direct market distribution of Marvel, DC and the mainstream comics, it was a separate distribution system that, was coming a few years after the Undergrounds had a brief national distribution system. But it's interesting. I mean, you could almost, I could imagine the kind of the interrelation between the kind of underground and above ground comics distribution methods being fodder for a good doctoral dissertation by somebody.
Oh, it's
a multifaceted, it's a multifaceted subject.
Well, and so, yeah, you're right. You know, you've got this intertwining of the indie comics and comic book shops and the main retailers or the main publishers. But then also completely intertwined with this is this idea of the direct market. And I found it fascinating. The book, Bob Suling is, I think is how you say his last name.
Or Phil Suling.
Oh,
yeah.
Phil Suling. Yeah. He, you know, he basically started the direct market distribution that would, you know, evolve over time to what we know today, mainly through Diamond Direct Comics.
Phil was one of these incredible characters. If he was a fictional character, people would say he was unrealistic. he was a public school teacher. He was this key member of the New York fan community, and he was a comics dealer on the side. He had a little used bookstore on the side too. He saw that there was this deficiency in the market, that when people wanted to buy comics, when retailers wanted to buy comics, they couldn't necessarily get the ones that they wanted in the quantities that they wanted. When fans wanted, you know, issue 16 of a specific comic that was supposed to come out this month, there wasn't a very reliable distribution system.
And why was that? I mean, that doesn't make any sense, because you'd seem like if somebody said, hey, I need 20 copies of this, that the printer, distributor, publisher would say, okay, we'll send these off to Sheboygan or whatever, and people would have them in their hands.
Well, it varied depending on who. So the at that time, before Phil Suling started his company, the new comics were distributed through news vendors.
Mm-hmm.
And there were this network of news vendors, and they were just different types of businesses. Some news vendors would just drop off random assortments of comics.
Oh, okay.
They would maybe have them tied in such a way where they would damage them all. There was no guarantee that if you're a kid who's reading Detective Comics, and you get it from your pharmacy, that the next issue will also be at the pharmacy. It just was kind of this chance.
Just kind of a random thing.
Some news distributors had really high levels of customer service for their customers who were interested in comics. So there were exceptions that were almost comic shop like.
Yeah.
But for large swaths of the country, it was an unreliable system, and that was kind of this. And that created this vacuum that Phil Suling was trying to fill.
What's fascinating about that statement that you just made is that you didn't know basically what comics were going to be at your store. And yet, if you look at the number of comics that were being sold in the millions, it's amazing that they could have been selling millions more if they would have had a distribution model that got the comics that people wanted in their hands.
Well, by 1973, which is when Phil Suling launches this business, this first direct distributor of mainstream comics, sales had actually dropped a lot.
So, oh, sure. I'm talking about, you know, in the
history
the
of the comics business.
Yeah.
So if you go back to like a heyday of like the 40s,
mm-hmm.
Captain Marvel and titles like that, Superman are selling like crazy. Now, then there's this boomlet of kind of a Batman craze with mm-hmm. the 1966 Batman show. But comic sales were in trouble. And this is this recurring theme in the comics business, by the way. It seems like the business is about to end every few years. Like, oh, look, here's the new crisis. You know, it's but in 1973, there were real concerns about the viability of the comics market for a lot of different reasons. A lot of the traditional retail network of pharmacies and grocery stores and things were that network was changing. It was less. A lot of retailers didn't like comics as much. So it was creating this really kind of rare willingness for the comics publishers to try something new. And it was, it was DC that did it first. And it created this system where you would basically get comics straight from the printers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a drop ship system, and Phil Suling was basically just doing the paperwork initially. You would place an order, and the printing plant and all the major comic publishers were located in Sparta, Illinois.
Right.
I was like the town full of printers, and they would just, so let's say I'm a major retailer. I am a major retailer in Los Angeles. I would place my order and the printer would collate my order just like they were collating the orders for all of the regional distributors. So I could, and it just, it made it so that you could order, you could know what you were ordering. And you also would get the comics earlier and in a more reliable fashion than you did before.
Well, and that was the other thing that was kind of neat about those people that were with a direct marketer like Phil Schuling, is that you might get comics and have them on the shelves a day or two or a week before the quote unquote regular stores would have them. And so that became a way to attract people to your stores, because you had the comics first, or you had the greatest selection of comics, or those kinds of things. And it seems like that's all due in part to, you know, getting your orders down and having someone doing the paperwork.
It is. And it created this, once other distributors popped up, and once the comics distribution business to comic shops became much more competitive, in the late 70s, it led to this kind of arms race. Everyone's trying to get their stuff first and coming up with new ways to get your stuff first. I could get it a day earlier than the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
Now when this idea of Wednesday being the day that comics always come out, it has been so long since any of us have lived in a world where the system was as unreliable as it was decades ago.
Yeah.
And also where, depending on where you shop, stuff might be available on different days.
Well, and that's true. When I was in college, and again, this is like early 90s, there were still a couple of other distributors. I don't think at this point Diamond had secured basically everybody yet. But I remember we would go down to a used bookstore that was our comic book store, and we had to get our new comics on Thursday just because of the way that shipments took to get to us. And then there was another used comic book store like two blocks down that would get some very different comics, but they were always about 2 weeks late. And so mm-hmm. it was just kind of this weird, okay, what store am I going to today? Which one am I supposed to stop at? Very rarely were we ever a true Wednesday new comic book day store. And so for me, when I did move to a bigger city, realizing that, oh, we got comic books on Wednesday at lunchtime, that was a big deal.
Oh yeah, and it's the combination of reliable delivery times and also the idea of a full selection.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be that a shop could stock everything,
right.
And that was realistic. Of course, the number of offerings today are so big, and so much of that stuff is not stuff that you'd really want to stock. It's like you don't really see that anymore.
Yeah,
but it was just a real real change, a really kind of pleasant change for a lot of fans.
About how long did Phil have, you know, the corner on distribution? Because it seems like once he saw that he had a model that was really working, it seems like everyone came out of the woodwork. And when you look at like 76 through about 85, the list of distributors just skyrockets.
So the one thing to note about his business. So his business, it would eventually be called Seagate Distributing.
Right.
And it started out very small. It started out with just a few accounts, and then it grew and grew. And then he set up this system of sub-distributors where he was selling to affiliates who would then sell to shops. But when it started, it was so small that people didn't really notice. And then it got bigger and bigger, and then there were other regional comics distributors that were they couldn't get some of the stuff that Phil had because he had the contracts with the major publishers.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted to get in on that. And the big change was precipitated by a couple different events, but one was a lawsuit in which a competing distributor sued Seagate, Phil's company, and sued all the publishers. And one of the things that arose from a series of settlements was it threw the door open to lots of different companies being able to distribute comics, and it led to this next era, this kind of Wild West era, where there are tons and tons of distributors, and they're competing to offer the best terms with tiny, tiny profit margins. They're going out of business. Mm-hmm. There, you know, and it went from kind of the chaos of one kind of overworked entrepreneur and a small company to just a madness of an industry that was growing like crazy, but where distributors were arriving and going out of business and merging and all this stuff, and before it kind of coalesced into a few big players getting into the 80s.
Yeah, and that's kind of where is that the heyday of comics is the 80s as far as the comic shop goes?
So, of course, we all think that the heyday is when we were I've heard it said that the heyday is when you were 10 years old.
Yeah, so
I was 10 years old in 1985.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, I feel like that really was the heyday. Like I think the actual – in talking to retailers, the kind of – the growth and the spirit that existed in the business in not quite 85, but maybe just a little bit before that, I feel like that was the heyday. That was when you were seeing you still had a lot of the first generation of retailers that were still in the business. And then you see the second generation arrive. And the second generation, a lot of them came into it with a little bit more business acumen.
Okay.
And a little bit more, and they had experience shopping at the first generation stores. And they had experience living their whole lives in the fan community, where first generation retailers in a lot of ways predated some of the fan community. So you have this great crossover generations, and there was also this flowering of independent comics that was happening then. You had ElfQuest was a really popular title. You had Cerebus, you had Love and Rockets. There was this vibrant competition. And a bunch of these independent companies, it happens every few years that there's talk that this or that independent publisher is finally going to give the big guys a run for their money.
Mm-hmm.
And it was happening then, you know, when Pacific Comics has Jack Kirby drawing a title, my goodness. All in that period from about 1980 to about 1983 or 84, there's just this real energy, and a key part of that is growth. It's when the business is growing that allows for experimentation, that allows and that was a time when the business was growing so quickly, and within that growth there were little dips here and there, because of course this is a comic business, so you can't go too long without a crisis.
Mm-hmm. But literally and figuratively.
Exactly. Yeah. But then once you get to the mid-80s, it seems like it becomes a little bit of a sadder story at that point.
Why was that?
The business grows up a bit.
Yeah, I wonder because I don't know. I've kind of talked on and off to a couple of comic creators who have been telling me about this time in like the 1980s that DC was really set to change the way that it was going to distribute comics, that it was going to sell comics, the format of the comics were going to greatly change. And then there was this winter storm of, I forget what year it was, 83 or something like that, that totally shut down distribution all along the East Coast. And so comics were delayed by weeks. And so when the sales numbers came in for that month of that winter storm, DC was like, oh no, comic books are not, we're not going to be able to do this right. And so they just kind of went with what everyone else was doing. And I don't know if you've heard that story or if you're more familiar with it than what I'm trying to tell.
I'm not familiar with the kind of a specific weather related event. In that period, there were a couple kind of mini downturns, and in the comics business, the mini downturns tend to be somewhat seasonal. Like there's this post Christmas downturn, and then there's also this
summer
back to school downturn.
Yeah,
and a lot of times, if bad things happen, that happens to coincide with one of those seasonal downturns, that's when you would see this kind of bunch of stores going out of business, or maybe a distributor going out of business.
So then what happened in the 80s then that caused the comic shops to just kind of either, flatten out or start to decline?
Well, it isn't that the business flattened out. I guess when I talk about the heyday, I guess I just mean kind of when it was fun,
when it was
a bunch of entrepreneurs and it was still growing and it was still this kind of, the business continued to grow. Once you get to the Batman movie in the late 80s, that was the moment when that led to this substantial sales boom for comics. And a bunch of comic shops, present-day comic shop owners got into the business just in time for that Batman movie.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a new business person and you don't really know what you're doing, there is nothing like crazy success falling from the sky to help you kind of get your sea legs. And so the businesses were successful. The industry was still growing. It just was becoming more. The word that comes to mind is corporate, but that's not the right word.
Yeah.
Because these companies were corporations for a long time. But what you saw was, it was the spirit of comic shops continued to change leading up to the kind of the great speculator boom and bust of the 90s.
I remember it was so that also has to coincide though when we talk about the speculator market is all about let's collect comics now, let's make them more valuable 30 years from now because, hey, someone uncovered a copy of Amazing Fantasy 15 and sold it for $1 million. I can pay my way to college by buying some comics now and selling them in 20 years. And the comic shops tended to play up on that. And, of course, the publishers did, too, because they were releasing variant cover after variant cover. And, hey, instead of one Batman title, let's have 50 different Batman titles or Wolverine or X-Men or whatever, especially X-Men. And so they kind of oversaturated the market and kind of choked themselves, didn't they?
They did. It was this mania in which there was an idea you could buy a comic and you could retire on selling your comics in 10, 15 years, which was utter insanity with X-Men number one, by Jim Lee and Chris Claremont, I believe it was
a million
the number
copies?
On that, what, eight million copies or something like that?
Yeah.
Or it was some ridiculous number. If you buy a comic in which there are millions of copies, especially when there are far fewer than millions of readers, you're not going to be able to sell that for much of a premium down the road. It's just simple supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
But there was this idea that you need to buy all of the different covers. And it was, and this led to, you know, soon after you saw the, you know, the death of Superman, and you saw the, and the, just the craziness of people buying cases and cases of new comics. One thing that the retailers were saying was that part of them was saying, oh my goodness, I need to cut back on my orders because this is nuts, you know, and they had been through booms and busts before, but then the demand would just continue and continue. And that expansion of sales, it went on a little bit longer than some experienced retailers thought it would. And it created this notion that, God, maybe this is just the way things are now. But of course it wasn't. You know, of course, when The Death of Superman, this is a comic that sells out almost everywhere on the first day.
Yep, I remember.
It's selling for these huge markups almost immediately. So a couple months later, and the whole reason The Death of Superman was such an important event was this naive idea that Superman's never going to come back. So was it 3 months later? I'm trying to remember how many months later it was.
It wasn't that much longer. And then they said, hey, guess what? We've got the return of Superman, or the reign of the Superman came. And then finally Superman comes back. It's like a year later or so.
Yeah, Superman comes back, and retailers so if there's a retailer who ordered 1,000 copies of The Death of Superman, and they sold them out in hours, and they could have sold 10 times as many if they had just ordered more. When that Return of Superman came out, instead of thinking, oh my God, this whole industry's been had, you know, this is like, they said, I'm going to order the heck out of that book.
Oh.
And the Return of Superman, which I believe was Adventures of Superman number 500, or was it 500, that was the comic that was the kind of, I don't know if canary in the coal mine is the way to describe it, but after that, you started to see comics that in which the order numbers were steadily dropping, in which all of these would-be hits turn out to be busts. And this is along the same time that Image is publishing all the stuff that's coming out way too late, that is just kind of poorly scheduled, and it leads to this spiral for the business, in which all but the very best shops, or all either the very best shops or the shops that had a ton of money available to them, would go out of business.
So that's an interesting statement right there. What makes a comic shop the very best, in your opinion? I mean, I'm sure you've done a lot of research into a lot of comic shops. I don't know if you've visited all 3,500 or however many are here in the United States. But you must have some idea.
Let me tell you.
Okay,
I would visit all 3,500 if I could somehow figure out a way to do that. but I visited a lot of comic shops, and I interviewed a lot of retailers of many different generations. And the thing that makes the difference, one of the best shops in the country is Flying Colors Comics in Concord, California. The owner is Joe Field. He's the guy who helped to come up with the idea for Free Comic Book Day. And something that he told me was that so much of surviving in the comics business is knowing how to manage the downturns. It's like it's one thing when everything's going great, when you don't even have to try and customers are coming in the door. But when sales are going down, when key titles that you're selling are all of a sudden much, much less popular, the thing that separates the stores that will survive from the ones that won't are the ones that have a loyal clientele, and that also that have developed the right kind of clientele, have developed a clientele of readers as opposed to kind of people who will just be there for short periods of time because they're kind of collectors, but not readers. I think a lot of the stores that went out of business were catering to more of a collector market. And that also can be a sustainable model, but it's just tougher.
Here I was hoping you would have some magical formula, like you have to have a large toy selection and you have to have a coffee shop adjoining.
Actually, let me give you, I wouldn't say I have a formula, but the stores that are really good, and I have short profiles of 40 shops in the book, the shops that are really good have a lot of things in common. They don't have a lot of things in common. They have a few things in common. One is they have a kids section. Mm-hmm. Kids comics are this rapidly growing part of the business. There are great kids comics today. The quality and the variety of kids comics are so much better today than they were when I was a kid. If you go to The Beguiling in Toronto, if you go to Flying Colors in California, if you go to Green Brain Comics in Dearborn, Michigan, a great store, mm-hmm. You go to Oh Yeah Comics in Muncie, Indiana, another great store. Like, they, not only do they have good kid sections, but they have owners and employees that know the kid section. So if a kid comes in, they know how to match that kid up with, and they know how to turn kids into comics readers. So a good kid section is a key element. Another key element is just kind of knowing your customers. Mm. And it sounds kind of silly and kind of obvious, but a lot of really good stores, they tell all their employees that when someone walks in the door, you say hello to them. And we're not in kind of a cheesy blockbuster video kind of everyone, you say hello to everyone. But, you know, you really take time to greet every person that walks through the door, and you ask if they need any help. A lot of times they're regulars, and you'll chat with them. But mm-hmm. just this idea of making contact with every person that comes in the door, and you and I have both been probably to a lot of really bad comic shops. And one of the things that bad comic shops tend to have in common is it's almost like the people there are indifferent to the customers. It's
yeah.
like they're just kind of, you feel like you're kind of interrupting their day.
Yeah.
And I guess if I was going to say a third thing, so kids section, kind of greeting and engaging with everybody. The third thing also is just sound financial practices. And this, of course, this is like a kind of a no duh thing, but
well,
it's hard to run a business. It's hard to contain costs so that you're bringing in more money than is going out the door. It is hard when this comic is supposed to be a big hit and it turns out to be a dud, so you're stuck with 100 extra copies. And there's a certain kind of not political conservatism, but business conservatism to a lot of the really good stores, where they just know to be careful, and they know and they're really thrifty. A lot of times they build their own fixtures. They when something needs to be repaired, they repair it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be, I would say, the third element of a successful store.
Yeah. I like what you said about, engaging with your customers and knowing who they are, because when you say that, I instantly think of two instances for me. One was a store that was in Atlanta when I lived there between 95 and 2000, where it took a couple of weeks, but pretty soon the guy that was there in the afternoons right after lunch started to know who I was, so that as soon as I walk in, he goes, "Oh, I've got your list. Did you see that we got this new comic? I saw that you had this in your pull pile. Have you heard of this one that you might be interested in as well?" And I really found that invaluable. The other one was the comic store that I went to when I was in college, and they had a kid there that was working there, and we had pull lists, and everybody would talk and chat, and every week it was nice to go in and just kind of catch up with people that were buying comics. I left for almost 10 years and came back, and I walked into their new comic book store the first week that I was back, and he knew me right away. He was like, "Oh, Steven." And I was like, "Yes, I'm surprised you remember me." And he goes, "You know what? We even still have your pull list if you want to start that back up again." And I was amazed by that. Now, of course, both of those comic shops have closed, but it still goes to show that customer experience can last for years after that interaction.
Well, and that's what gets a comic shop through tough times too. If you're indifferent to your shop, whatever your local shop is, whatever one that's convenient because of where you live, if you're visiting some other town, you might just shop there, or you'll easily go and shop somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But if you feel a real loyalty to a particular place, you're going to stick with them when they're going through a rough few months for one reason or another. And it makes a big difference. I think in kind of talking about people just knowing you, the stores that I've really enjoyed in this project are ones where I've just been there once, And I feel at home. Like Legend Comics and Coffee in Omaha, Nebraska is so I sat on their coffee side and drank coffee, had a pastry. They had all these I was reading an old Batlash Showcase Presents that they had out for coffee drinkers to thumb through. And then I go over to the comic side and I'm going through it. I got Adventure Comics number 300 in terrible condition for like $20. And I was talking to one of the co-owners, and it was a really nicely laid out store. And I was just thinking, man, I just wish I could go to the store every week. Now I have really like the store I go to here in Columbus, Ohio, but it's like some of these businesses are so good that you only need to be there for 10, 15 minutes. And you're just like, man, I like this place. You know, yeah. I want to go back.
Yep. Many of them are flashing through my mind right now as we speak. There's also a bunch of forgettable stores too, unfortunately. What would you say to someone who's like, I've got a great idea. I'm going to open a comic book shop in my town. Is now a good time to be opening comic book shops?
I think that it's a treacherous time to for a brick and mortar retail business. Period. At the same time, if you look at the history of comics retail, it's just fraught with ups and downs. Mm-hmm. There have been so many bad times to open a store. There have been so many bad times to open a store when stores open and are successful. So the thing to really pay attention to is how saturated is that local market?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're 10 blocks from Legend Comics and Coffee in Omaha, you probably don't want to open a store there because they're really good. But if you're in an area, especially if you're in like a small city, if you're in a city of, say, I think of Aw Yeah Comics in Muncie, which I'll mention again. They do a great job, and the way that they serve that market, it develops a market, and it isn't like there's six stores they're competing against right in that town.
Right.
So it's just a matter of looking at who the competition would be. Also, it helps to be, you know, what your demographics are. There's a lot of great shops tend to do well in neighborhoods near colleges.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to, you see a lot of really successful suburban stores. It's one of those things where at this time, if you're opening a brick and mortar retail business, you really have to have a plan. And it also costs more to get into the business than it used to. It used to be that you could, the barrier to entry was so low that you could have $1,000. You could have first month's rent and your own comics collection, and you could start a shop back in the 70s.
Yeah.
Today, if you're going into it with, you would definitely need six figures, and it would be, depending on your location, depending upon how much you want to spend on fixtures, it would likely be substantially more just to really give it a good go.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a substantial barrier of entry for a lot of people. And that's why you see a lot of groups of people opening shops as opposed to just, you know, kind of a single owner operator.
Yeah. For someone who has like 50,000 comics in his collection, when digital comics came out, I was all gung-ho. I was like, this is going to change the industry. And because, you know, I can have my entire collection now on a really thin, small, portable device, and I can carry, you know, every issue of Action Comics with me around forever. How has digital comics, how have they impacted or hurt or helped retailers?
Any comment about digital comics needs to be prefaced by the giant caveat that sales figures are not super reliable
and
not super available.
Gosh, but that's the one thing that I hate the most.
Yeah, but you look at like ICB2 and other outlets in talking to retailers and in talking to fans, it's digital comics. There is not this clear shift among the customer base to digital comics to such an extent that it hurts. Like, other things hurt comics retailers more. Like, Marvel underperforming right now hurts tons more than any competition from digital, if you talk to a retailer. Certain types of comics are affected by digital more. Manga is affected more. Comics that appeal to younger readers are affected more. But it's in the book, I briefly mentioned near the beginning that digital comics have not taken a huge, a measurably significant share away from print comics. And as I wrote that, that was clearly what was true at the time. I think it's still true now.
Yeah.
I am concerned, though, that that's one thing that's not going to age very well, because we just don't know what the future holds. And I wonder if, you know, I wonder what it'll be like in a year or two. Also, I wonder as the reading devices improve in quality, I just wonder if we'll get to the point where there's a tablet that's just so cool that the reading experience is so good. But I don't know. Right now, I would say that the physical comic shop has got some life left in it and could have a lot of life left in it.
I think so, too. And that's one thing that I've started to, as the digital comics are now approaching, what, almost 10 years now, maybe not close to 10 years, maybe more like 7 years, 7 or 8 years. But I've noticed that if I want to read a book like Comic Shop by you, the perfect digital format for me is like an iPad mini, because that's a nice little paperback size. If I want to read comic books, I really need an iPad Pro, because that's more along the lines of the format and the shape of a comic book. And if, you know, I know we had digital comics before iPads, people would read them on their computers, but really those were unwieldy and not portable and not convenient. So as much as I was gung-ho for digital comics when they were first announced, you're right, they haven't had a big impact on physical sales. So I kind of feel like retailers, brick-and-mortar stores that were super nervous about this are probably breathing a sigh of relief. And I also think that, just like you, I think a good comic shop will be able to last for decades before something replaces them.
Yeah, I feel like you look at like the total number of shops, I would not be at all surprised if 5 years from now that's a lower number.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there are a lot of marginal stores out there.
Yeah.
And a lot of the really good stores, even if there's some sort of apocalyptic event in the industry where major publishers just stop, not that I expect that to happen, but it's like some of these places have such a built-in audience that it's like people just want to keep going there. They want, yeah, and they can exist. There are a couple shops that say they have that kind of doomsday plan, which is we're going to just be an antiquarian comics dealer and books and used comics.
Yeah,
and that would be their approach, and they think they could make a go of it that way. So
yeah, I know I've talked to, yeah, I know of one shop that's what they've done. They've stopped dealing with new comics, and all they are is a trade paperback and a collector comic book store. And they say they're doing fine. They've been doing this for like 4 years now, and they say sales are just fine.
Yeah, it's a different audience though, and it takes some getting used to. So if you're a lot of, especially retailers that have been around for a while, get so used to that Wednesday business and the regulars, and it's just managing a business, having that reliable cash flow on your weekly business. It's a different kind of customer who's buying comics in book form. They don't come in as often, but they have larger total purchases with each trip. So just for planning purposes and for ordering purchases, it's tough. But for those that do it well, if you look at like Comics Experience in San Francisco, which definitely emphasizes comics in book form, and there are a bunch of other examples like that, like Big Planet Comics, the original Big Planet Comics in the Washington, D.C. suburbs is another one. They've kind of trained their audience. They have people who come in and are Wednesday customers and are buying periodical comics, but they've largely switched over to a bookstore model.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dan, this has been a fascinating chat about comic shops, and I know if people want to know more, they should go check out your book. Tell me the name of the book. tell us when it comes out and where people can find it.
So the book is called Comic Shop, The Retail Mavericks Who Gave Us a New Geek Culture. It is coming out, if you're buying it in a comic shop, which I would recommend, it's going to be in comic shops October 11th if your store pre-ordered it. Mm-hmm. I hope they did. If you're ordering through other outlets, it'll be available right around then too. I think the official publication date is that same week as the Diamond ship date to comic shops.
Oh, all right.
You can find out more about me by going to dangarino.com. My website I just started and that I hope isn't terrible. but yeah.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for your time. And listeners, go check out this book. I'm only about halfway through it. I've only had a chance to sit down and read it over the last weekend or so, but it's very fascinating. It's very interesting. I think there's some good history in there for those of you that want to know how we got to here. This book does a good job at covering that. So, Dan, thank you so much for your time.
Yep, thank you very much, Stephen.
That wraps it up for this installment of the Major Spoilers podcast. Again, thank you so much for downloading and listening and being part of the Major Spoilers experience. If you found some value in this, if you've learned a little something from this week's show, then maybe give a little back. Head over to patreon.com/majorspoilers. We can't do this stuff without your help. And I know that you want shows like Major Spoilers and Critical Hit and Zach on Film and everything else that we do to continue. And we can only do that with your help. And you can help us by going to patreon.com/majorspoilers. Sign up today and get a bunch of extra stuff. In the meantime, we're going to be back with a regular show, with a regular crew all next week because we know that you love comics. We do too. And we will talk with you soon.
Stop talking about comic books or I'll kill you. I don't care if the Hulk could defeat the Man of Steel. I'm going to rearrange your face.
This podcast is copyright 2017 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.